When a truly unique event occurs, it takes more effort for us to put it together in our minds, doesn't it? When was the last time you or I observed something that was truly one of a kind? By their very nature, as unique, as one of a kind events, these kinds of things don't happen very often in our lives. I mean, can you think of a one-of-a-kind experience that you've had? And so we may easily fail to recognize what's happening when we see a one-of-a-kind type of thing. It may take some time, some effort to process what's going on and to really figure it out. I'll give you an example of what I mean. Back in 1994, 95, I'm not sure exactly which year, I was sitting in my office in the church that I was pastoring at the time, Menor Road Bible Church in Elizabeth, Pennsylvania. And that church building, like this one, was situated on a country road, except it was situated much closer to a country road, just a few feet away. And so it was usually pretty quiet, and that day the quiet was shattered by a noise that was truly unique, unlike anything I had ever heard before. Now, I could tell that there was wood involved in this percussion-type noise, but there were other elements involved in the noise as well. It was a truly unique sound, something I have never heard since, and I had not heard until that day. And so I walked out of my office into the auditorium, toward the back of the auditorium, where I thought that the sound had originated. And there in the back of the auditorium, there was a table built into the corner. And on top of it were two concrete blocks, along with some dust. And I'm thinking, who would have put concrete blocks there? And then I remembered the sound, and I'm thinking, who would have dropped concrete blocks there? And so it took me a few seconds, probably half a minute at least, to really piece together what my eyes were seeing. And if I recall correctly, at the end of about 30 seconds, 45 seconds, I realized that there was just the tip, the top corner of the back of a dump truck sticking through the wall of the church. And that's what had deposited the concrete blocks on that table and made that one-of-a-kind noise. I told you it was a truly unique, one-of-a-kind experience. So it took me another few minutes of investigation to figure out that a roofing company had been hired by our neighbors across the road from us. And the workmen had pulled the dump truck up into their driveway and had failed to set the parking brake. And in time, the truck began to drift backward and it picked up speed. And it actually, as it came across the road, it hit a car coming up the road and spun it around 360 degrees. If it had not hit that car, I truly believe that dump truck would have come all the way into our auditorium. But as it was, because the wall of the church is just a few feet from the road at that point, it came back across the road, beyond the road, and into the wall of our auditorium. Now, there is more to this one-of-a-kind story, and if you want to hear it, you will have to come back next Sunday for the second part of this message, okay? In John chapter 1, we have the record of the most unique event in human history. Now, we celebrate that unique event at this time of year. I recently heard someone call Jesus' birth the most important event in human history, and I cannot agree with that assessment. Jesus' death and resurrection are the most important events in human history. But the birth of Jesus that we celebrate at this season is indeed the most unique event in human history. And because it is the most unique event ever, it will take us some time and some effort to put it all together. As I said, unique events by their very nature are not easy for us to comprehend. We can easily mistake this event. Millions have, down through the centuries since it took place. So this morning, we're going to take time, like I did that day in the church, we're going to take time to investigate this event this morning. And we're going to have to really open our eyes, and we're going to have to think about what we see and hear and read in order to really put it together properly. So stick with me this morning. The record of this most unique event in human history is found here in John chapter 1, verses 14 through 18. So let's read them together. John 1, verses 14 through 18. And the Word became flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld His glory. The glory is of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. John bore witness of him and cried out, saying, This was he of whom I said, He who comes after me is preferred before me, for he was before me. And of his fullness we have all received, and grace for grace. For the law was given through Moses, but grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. No one has seen God at any time. The only begotten Son who is in the bosom of the Father, He has declared Him. Now, we sometimes don't realize it, but these verses are part of the Christmas story. John does not begin his gospel with an account of the nativity of Jesus like Matthew does, like Luke does. He doesn't treat the details of Jesus' birth. Nevertheless, he does begin his gospel by explaining the meaning of Jesus' birth. Now, this morning, we have time only to focus on verse 14. We'll take up the remainder of the passage next Sunday, Lord willing. But since almost every word or short phrase in this verse is pregnant with meaning, it will be quite enough to fill our time this morning. So the most unique event in history begins with God the Son, the second member of the Trinity. Here in John 1, He is called the Word. The first three words of verse 14, and the Word, carry us back to the first three verses here of John chapter 1. Look back with me. John 1 and verse 1. In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was in the beginning with God. All things were made through Him, or literally, all things became through Him. And without Him, nothing was made that was made. So it's obvious from these verses that when John uses the title, the Word, he is speaking of some member of the Godhead. I mean, he says point blank at the end of verse 1, the Word was God. So who is this person in the Godhead that John is referring to as we read through John chapter 1? we find that this person was announced by John the Baptist. Verse 15 makes that very clear. And as we continue through John 1 and through the rest of the book of John, the identity of this person becomes unquestionable. John is using the title, the Word, to refer to Jesus Christ. Jesus is that member of the Godhead whom John calls the Word. Now, what does John mean to teach us by calling Jesus the Word? Now, if you study John's writings, John has a knack for taking the complex and making it simple. John likes to use little words. Used to have a man that worked for me. He had been in the military for years. And he loved to use acronyms. I don't know if it was because of his Army background. We worked in IT at the time, so there was no shortage of acronyms. ERM, ERP, EIM, SOA, you name it. I mean, there was just so many acronyms. And I got the idea at times as I would talk with this man that worked for me, as he threw around all of these acronyms, that he really didn't understand what he was talking about sometimes. I mean, I couldn't even tell you what some of those acronyms stand for. And so I would stop him and I would say, look, will you explain to me what you are talking about and only use little words? You see, if somebody can't explain something to you and only use little words, then they don't really understand it themselves. There's a lot of people in education like this. They can throw around big, giant words, and I don't really think they understand what they're talking about. I want to say to them, look, will you explain what you're talking about and only use little words? And the same thing goes for theology, doesn't it? At times we suspect people using these big theological words, incarnation. You know, what does that mean? And we want to say the same thing. We want to say, look, will you explain what you're talking about and only use little words? Well, John is great for only using little words. He uses this little four-letter word, W-O-R-D, to explain to us the part that the Son of God plays in the Trinity. That's amazing! He explains the function of the second member of the Trinity in a four-letter word. Now, what is a word? I could give you a big, long explanation of how the Jews in Jesus' day attached a certain meaning to the concept of the Word based on events in the Old Testament. I could give you a similar big, long explanation of how the Greeks in Jesus' day attached certain philosophical meanings to this word, the Word. In fact, if you read the commentaries, that's what you'll get. And I don't think John was talking about any of that. I think John was doing what John always does. He was trying to just make this very, very simple, using a word that would be explanatory in any time and age and era. What's a word? A word is a means of communication. When I use words, I reveal my thoughts. I reveal my plans. I reveal my motives. Words are a revelation of my mind, my will, my emotions. Words communicate my heart. Everybody knows what a word is. Sometimes you ladies try to communicate with us men and you get nothing but grunts. Some guys are great for grunting at their wives or their girlfriends. But a grunt doesn't really communicate anything. You know, it's really a dangerous form of communication, guys. Because your wife or your girlfriend may be free to take that grunt to mean just about anything she wants it to mean. If you really want to communicate, you have to use words. And that is exactly what Jesus was when he came to earth. That's exactly what he is to this day. He revealed the heart of God. He communicated the mind of God, the emotion of God, the will of God to us. I've always loved the way that the author of the book of Hebrews puts this in Hebrews chapter 1. God, who at various times and in various ways spoke in time past to the fathers by the prophets, has in these last days spoken to us by His Son. God has spoken to us by His Son, the Word. Think of it from this perspective. Human beings, by their efforts, by their intellect, by their will to discover, could never discover God. Men may plumb the depths of the oceans. They may gaze through their microscopes into the nano regions of electrons and positrons. They may cure cancer and HIV. They may travel to the stars. In fact, I don't know if you saw it this week. Two space probes. I love this. Two space probes named Eve and Wally. Sent back up close pictures of Mars back to Earth. Human beings are capable of discovering ever so much about this universe. But human beings are not capable of discovering God. He is beyond us. His ways are higher than our ways. His thoughts are higher than our thoughts. There's no way we can conceivably discover Him. God is beyond human beings in that sense. If God had not determined to reveal Himself first by means of this book, in these words, and then ultimately and supremely by means of Jesus Christ, we would not know Him. And hearing that truth, that God the Son is the Word, that in the very nature of the Trinity, God reveals Himself to us, we ought to all stand up and sing the doxology. God has revealed Himself to us. The second member of the Trinity is the Word. Can I hear an amen? So God communicated His heart in the Word, in Jesus Christ. Now, that communication to us took a definite form. What I am calling the most unique event in history. God the Son became something that He never was before. Okay, stop. Stop. Think about what I just said. God the Son, that first Christmas, became something that He never was before. It was a moment of creation. Go back to verse 3. Look back at John 1 and verse 3. It says, all things were made by Him. And as I said, literally the translation there is, all things became by Him. Very same word is used here in verse 14 when it says, the Word became flesh. It was a moment of creation. The moment after that, He was something that He had never been before. One commentary put it this way: all things became through him. He in turn became flesh. He became that which first became through him. I like that. He became that which first became through him. Now, we need to be careful here. Remember what I said at the beginning of this message. When we encounter a truly one-of-a-kind event, we really have to engage our minds in order to comprehend what's going on. And that is certainly the case with this, the most unique event in history. So when God the Son, when the Word became flesh, when He became human, He did not cease to be God. Let me put it this way. When God the Son was born of a virgin, He lost none of His godness. None. He remained 100% God. He didn't become 50% God and 50% human. He remained 100% God. In fact, John here in verse 14 is going to testify to that truth in the remainder of the verse. The Word became human, but He still had the glory as of the only begotten of the Father. Deity. But what John is really emphasizing here by using the word flesh is he is wanting us to understand that at that moment, Jesus became 100% man. Man inside and out. He had a real human body, a real human soul. The word flesh that's used here in verse 14 is used throughout the New Testament to speak of our human nature in total. Now, that human nature in us is fallen and sinful. That's why when we hear the word flesh in the New Testament, it's not normally in a good context, is it? It's normally talking about our sinful, fallen human nature. Now, Jesus didn't take on any of that sin. His human nature was not subject to the fall. But what He did was to take on a fully complete human nature. Now, why am I jumping up and down and making such a big deal out of this? What you have to understand is, you know, we think that cults are a modern thing. By the time John was writing in 70, 80 AD, around in that period, there were already cults. And one of these cults tried to mix up popular Greek philosophy from that day with Christianity, okay? And one of the popular Greek beliefs of that day was that matter, anything material, was inherently sinful and evil. So if matter, if this stuff is inherently evil and sinful, and we're trying to say that Jesus became flesh, that Jesus became human, they would say, no, you don't understand. Jesus only seemed to be human. He only seemed to have a human body. He was 100% God, and He just seemed to be man. By saying here in verse 14, the Word became flesh, John was putting the lie to any teaching like that. Jesus became 100% man. He had a fully human mind, a fully human soul, a fully human body. He was able to die on the cross as a substitute for us, because He was fully human in any sense of that word. So, John teaches us here in the first four words of verse 14, the most basic truth about Jesus Christ. He is 100% God and 100% man. Can you say that with me? 100% God, 100% man. That is the glory of Christmas. That is what's worth celebrating at this time of year. You know, I go out to buy Christmas cards, and it is such a depressing experience. You know, Hallmark, they love to say things like, love was born at Christmas. Well, I don't necessarily disagree with that sentiment, but it's a sentiment. Okay, the reason we celebrate at this time of year is that God became man so that He could win our salvation. That's worth celebrating! That's the most unique event in human history. The Word, God the Son, became flesh, became fully human. Well, John goes on from this point here in verse 14 to tell us how he experienced the most unique event in human history. You know, I opened this message by relaying to you how I experienced that event that day at Menor Road Bible Church. And kind of wedged here in the middle of verse 14, John relays to us how he experienced this unique event. God the Son taking full human flesh. He uses a very interesting word here. Our English versions translate it dwelt. This God-man dwelt among us. Now, as many of you know, that word dwelt can just as easily be translated tabernacled. The word is the verb form of the word tent or the word tabernacle. It is used in the Greek translation of the Old Testament, of the Old Testament tabernacle. And so we must connect that word, we must connect this idea with the Old Testament tabernacle. And then we need to connect that thought with the next phrase in which John says, we beheld His glory. So John combines two ideas here, tabernacle and glory. That conjuring up anything in your mind? John is remembering the times in the Old Testament in which the Shekinah glory of God came down and filled the tabernacle. Near the end of the book of Exodus, in Exodus 29:43, as God is outlining the design of the tabernacle and its offerings, we read this verse, "And there I will meet with the children of Israel, and the tabernacle shall be sanctified by my glory." So God said, I'm going to meet with you in the tabernacle. And when I do, you will see my glory. The glory of God would fill the Holy of Holies. You remember the story? The glory of God would come and abide in the tabernacle, and Moses would go out and meet with God. You remember the story? And when he would come back, his face would shine because he had been so close to the glory of God that was being manifest in that place. So John here, as he's trying to put together what this unique event in human history means, that God the Son became flesh, as he's trying to put this together, his mind harks back to the Old Testament stories of the Shekinah glory in the tabernacle. John tells us that is what we, the disciples, saw. We saw the Shekinah glory of God in a different kind of tabernacle. In the tabernacle of Jesus' human body. Now, let me ask you a question. When did John see the Shekinah glory of God displayed in the human body of Jesus? Can somebody say it loudly? At the Mountain of Transfiguration. See, this wasn't something that happened every day. I don't think John was talking about his everyday experiences with Jesus, walking on the roads in Galilee, eating in the upper room. It's interesting that John, in this gospel, doesn't speak of the transfiguration anywhere else, only here. But listen to what the other Gospels say. Listen to their descriptions of the transfiguration. Here's from Matthew. Now after 6 days, Jesus took Peter, James, and John, his brother, led them up on a high mountain by themselves, and he was transfigured before them. His face shone like the sun, and his clothes became white as the light. Here's from Mark. He was transfigured before them. His clothes became shining, exceedingly white like snow, such as no launderer on earth can whiten them. Here's Luke. As he prayed, the appearance of his face was altered, and his robe became white and glistening. These guys are grasping at straws trying to find out words to describe this. Because they're describing the Shekinah glory of God being manifest through the human body of Jesus Christ. So get a hold of what's going on here. I believe that John here, just kind of as a footnote almost, is telling us how he pieced together the great theological truth that Jesus was God and man. He was able to piece this together because of what he saw on the Mountain of Transfiguration. And I don't think he pieced it together immediately. I think it took him months, maybe years. But at some point in John's experience, looking back on what happened on the Mountain of Transfiguration when he saw the glory of God displayed through the humanity of Jesus, he came to understand that the Word became flesh. That God, the Son, 100% God, became flesh, 100% man. And he pieced it together at some point because of this unique event he saw on the top of the Mount of Transfiguration. Now, the words here in verse 14 also emphasize the very personal observation and experience that John had with Jesus, with the God-man. The words here in verse 14, dwelt among us and we beheld, emphasize this point, his personal observation of Jesus. He had the chance to make these observations up close and personal. That verb that's translated dwelt can also be translated dwelt in a tent with. How many of you have ever dwelt in a tent with anyone? It's a rather up close and personal experience, isn't it? Now, I myself put the idea of camping somewhere roughly above rolling in the mud. That's right about where I put it in, you know, what I want to do with my time. It's not really, I'm not really a camper. So I can't say that I have ever really dwelt in a tent with anyone, but my son Justin loves to camp. Has since he was a kid. And I can remember setting up a four-man tent in our backyard for Justin and three of his buddies that were spending the night with us. And I and remember, Jeannie will testify to this, in the morning when Jeannie and I went out to check on the boys, the tent looked like it has exploded. The tent was flattened and there were sleeping bags all over the yard. To tell the truth, we were a little bit scared when we first saw the scene. We couldn't really tell if the boys were dead or alive. And apparently being in the tent together all night long was a little too up close and personal for those four guys. Because they definitely had to spread out. That's part of what John is trying to communicate here. That he was up close and personal with the most unique person to ever walk on the face of the planet. He beheld him in ways that we cannot. The first few verses in 1 John, not the gospel, but 1 John, he says, we saw him, we beheld him, we listened to him, and then it says, we even handled him. John knew what he was talking about from up close and personal observation. Remember, this was the beloved disciple who leaned on Jesus' breast. And really, that's what this entire book that we call the Gospel of John is about. It's the testimony of John, up close and personal, to this God-man. Now, John closes out this verse by again emphasizing the uniqueness of this event in human history. There are two phrases at the verse, at the end of verse 14. And both of them emphasize how unique this event was, how unique the God-man is. First, John tells us that the glory that he beheld on the Mount of Transfiguration was the glory as of the only begotten of the Father. Now remember, John is emphasizing here that this person, the Word, took flesh. He became fully human. And so I think John wanted to make sure that we didn't misunderstand that Jesus ceased to be God when he became fully man. And so he uses this phrase that he continued after he took flesh to have the glory as of the only begotten of the Father. Now, that word only begotten, we're used to that phrase. You know, all of us, that's one of the first phrases from the Bible we use. Why is that? We learn this almost immediately. Why? Because it's used in John 3:16. Okay? But oftentimes we don't really know what it means. Okay? How many of you here are an only child? Okay, anybody? Okay, an only child. That's what it means. Only begotten, one and only. So it's saying here that Jesus had the glory as of the only, the one and only child of God the Father. Basically, what John is saying is he had the glory as God himself would pass down to his only child. See? Now, what is so wonderful about that is that you have a paradox here in this passage. Back in verse 12, another one of those verses from John that we all memorize, right? But as many as received him, to them gave he the power to become... What? What? Now, wait a minute. Anybody who receives Jesus by faith becomes a son of God. Now, wait a minute. Wait a minute. John in verse 14 says that Jesus is the only Son of God. The only begotten Son of God. Now, which is it? This is what's called a false dichotomy. Okay? It's not either or, it's both and. Yes, by placing our faith in the Lord Jesus Christ, we become the children of God. But we do not become the Son of God in the sense that Jesus is. He will always be the unique Son of God, 100% God, 100% man. This is where many of the cults, the modern day cults, Mormonism in particular, gets it wrong. One of the presidents of the Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, summarized their doctrine like this: as man is, God once was. As God is, man may become. The implication of that teaching is that we as human beings can indeed become Jesus Christ, the unique Son of God. But what John tells us here is that that is not true. What John saw on the Mount of Transfiguration led him to understand that Jesus was and is the unique Son of God. In a way that no other human being could ever be the Son of God. He displayed in that moment the very same glory as God the Father. He is unique, one of a kind, and only child. And then the last part of the verse speaks of the mission of this God-man. Literally, John here calls Jesus the only begotten from the Father. And that word "from" implies that Jesus not only has a unique birth, Jesus not only has a unique person, he has a unique mission. And it's the last phrase of the verse that summarizes that mission, full of grace and truth. And as we come to this phrase, we have finally come to the point to which we have been traveling for this entire message. There's a sense in which this entire message is an introduction to what I'm going to preach next Sunday. Because of the most unique event in history, because of the unique person that Jesus is, because of the event that we commemorate at Christmas, Jesus is full of grace and truth. And that fullness is our blessing. Notice verse 16. And of His fullness, full of grace and truth, and of His fullness we have all received, and grace for grace. The mission of this God-man focuses on us. Can we celebrate all over again? His mission focuses on us. Think of it this way. Because of the most unique event in history, because he is the most unique person in history, Jesus has the unique resources to minister to us as no one else can. And next week, we're going to talk about that ministry that Jesus has to us, because he's the most unique person in history. This is what Christmas is all about. Forget the glitter. Forget the lights. Forget the schmaltzy music. God became man so that he would have unlimited resources to pour into our lives. This is what we celebrate at Christmas. As I close, I want to step back for a minute. And I want you to see how important it is that we understand, that we believe, that Jesus is 100% God and 100% man. Because salvation is impossible if Jesus is not 100% God and 100% man. First of all, Jesus had to be 100% man so that he could be the substitute for you and for me. See, in the Old Testament, what was the substitute? Lambs. Cows, bulls. The author of the book of Hebrews says, ultimately, that just doesn't cut it. The only acceptable substitute for you and me is another human being. If Jesus was not a human being, fully human, then we have no one who can bear our sin, who can be the sacrifice for us. Jesus had to be 100% human. But Jesus also had to be 100% God. Why? Because God is an infinite being. See, one human being can be a substitute for one human being. But an infinite being can be the substitute for all human beings and can bear the sin, the infinite, eternal sin of every human being. And so it had to be the God-man who went to the cross to bear your sin and mine. And so the question I have for you is, have you embraced the God-man as your Savior and your Lord? Have you said, yes, He is my Savior. He is my Lord. I'm trusting what the God-man did when He died and He rose again.